Robert Stark here. I'm joined here today with Matt Forney. Hey, Matt.
Thank you for having me on again, Robert. It's a pleasure to be doing this with you yet again.
So, we're going to be discussing your article from Tacky Mag. It's called Twit Planet, and the overall theme is the millennial generation, which I suppose both you and I are part of, and I think my friend Paul Bingham calls it, he calls them millennials, he calls them Generation Faggot.
I was always wondering what he meant by that. I mean, I see him using it all the time on Facebook, but anyway, yeah. For those of you who haven't read it in the audience, the article's it's a review come analysis of Roosh's new book, Pussy Paradise, which is sort of a memoir of his experiences living in Romania and sort of reaching the end of his journey, as it were, in learning how to seduce women. And the understated tone, at least what I took away from Pussy Paradise, is that, you know, sexual relationships in among the millennial generation, relationships between men and women are just so utterly broken that I really don't see a hope for most of us.
And by broke, well, I'll ask you, I'll bring something up because, you know, Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity over on Fox News, they did this spring break special, and the theme of the special was kind of like they come across as the stereotypical old guys who are, like, complaining that young people are too out of control. But you actually make the point that a lot of people, young people are actually not, they're not having fun, they're just totally disconnected. They're spending a lot of time on their iPhones, playing video games on the internet, looking at.
Yeah, well, you know, O'Reilly and Hannity, they're in the business of, you know, getting ratings. And you can't really very well make an exciting week-long series of about kids just sitting at home playing video games and twiddling on their iPhones. But yeah, this is pretty much borne out by the evidence. The millennials are probably the least adventurous generation in recent history. As I mentioned in the article, statistically, millennials are having less sex than previous generations. Millennials don't have driver's licenses compared to previous generations. And every other metric, basically, the stereotype of well, some of this is dictated by economic realities, like, you know, a lot of kids, college grads these days end up living with their parents and working on minimum wage jobs because that's all there is left unless you have some really specialized degree. But a lot of it's just plain weird, you know, technological obsession and just a weird sort of autism, which people are unable to connect to with each other without the use of computers or technology.
And with you mentioned autism, like, the attitude that society has towards mental illness is everyone who's mentally ill, the psychiatrists say it's because their brain is wired the wrong way and they need medication. I think the situation people are in can cause mental illness. If someone is if someone's spending all their time, say, on the internet and not interacting with people, I think that can cause traits of mental illness.
Yeah, pretty much. I really didn't have the space to get into this in the Tacky Mag article, but a lot of the blame for the way millennials are can be laid at the feet of the generation that raised them, which is primarily the baby boomers. Helicopter parenting, the various panics about, you know, don't talk to strangers, you might get swooped up by a van by a child molester, you know, child sex offender scare hysteria. All of us, I mean, I don't know what your particular life was like with Robert, but I grew up just sort of surrounded by this sort of hysteria, as did my sisters and all my friends. And I wasn't exactly helicopter parented, but we lived in a much more closed environment, a much more restrictive environment than our previous generations did. And this is showing in our psychological attitudes. You know, it's like And of course, and you bring up the mental health issues. Like, I mean, we all know of the diagnoses of ADD, ADHD that a lot of young boys are given in school these days because they're too rampunctious to sit down in the female-dominated classrooms and just, you know, whatever. So you get these sort of they're all put on drugs to modify their behavior, and the end result is that we have a generation that is drugged up, doped up, not on illegal drugs, but on pharmaceutical, mind-altering pharmaceuticals, antidepressants, and have been educated by their parents from a very young age to basically just avoid anything that might even be remotely dangerous, and this is showing in the way we behave.
And I guess give some examples of how that the way they're brought up might create barriers to those to young millennials or especially young men living a fulfilling life.
Well, as I said, for example, as I just mentioned, the stranger danger thing. Like a while back, I remember reading an article in the New York Times. It was sort of a review of the classic – at that time, the classic original Sesame Street episodes from the 60s were being released on DVD. And the New York Times was commenting on how a lot of the advice in these Sesame Street episodes would be considered radically unsafe by parents today because
oh,
you have
– like in Sesame Street, you have the little kids like talking to strange adults.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean – my parents were like, when I was a kid, like, don't talk to strangers. Don't talk to strangers because you don't know what they are. You don't know who they are. You don't know what, you know, motivation you have. And a lot of this has you're familiar with the whole hollaback street harassment type thing that feminists complain about. Personal space, men taking up too much space in the subways and having their personal space violated. I think this is a direct byproduct of that. We have a generation that was basically raised to avoid social interaction, raised to basically not have any sort of close contact with anyone. So the point where they're in public and they have to run into contact with anyone, they just can't handle it. I mean, one of the most ridiculous examples I pointed out in that Tacky Mag article was this woman who had deployed a personal space box, and I think it was the DC Metro, in which she basically just took a wireframe box and put it around her while she was on the subway to basically just keep everyone away from her. It's like these people are, particularly women, are just so averse to contact with people they don't know that they respond in these frankly bizarre and antisocial ways.
And what you pointed out that Roosh is a Generation Xer. The Generation Xers are in between the millennials and the baby boomers. What are some of the significant traits of that generation?
Well, I'd say I've discussed this before with guys like Andy Nowak and Ann Sterzinger, who are Gen Xers themselves. Going by Robert, are you familiar with The Fourth Turning, the book?
Yeah, this is where I get most of my... you actually brought it up one of our previous shows.
Yes, basically. The Generation X is defined by the fact that they came of age when the old traditional America or old traditional West was sort of coming apart. So they got a taste of what life was like before the revolution of the 60s, as it were, the social revolution, but they saw it as it was coming to pieces, which is what defined the extreme cynicism and maybe nihilism of Gen X and Gen X writing. But Gen Xers are, as a whole, generally are much more sociable than millennials and much more adventurous in many ways.
I mean, I'm a millennial, but I actually get along better with Generation Xers than people who are my age or younger.
right now my best friend is a Gen Xer, like, you know, so, and I've been told, well, one of my exes described me years ago as basically like being a 40-year-old trapped in a 20-year-old's body. So it's like guys like us have a sort of weird disposition. It's like I feel at head loggerheads with most people my age.
And I mean, I'm going in college, so a lot of the people I interact with, I mean, their people are significantly younger. Like, their people were born in, like, the early 90s.
Oh, God, I can't imagine what it's like talking to those. That's the generation that basically knew nothing but the internet. Like, I can remember, you guys like you and I, we can remember an age before Facebook, and remember an age before ubiquitous social networking, before Twitter, before internet obsession. The people growing up who were born in the early 90s and going forward have basically lived their entire lives, young adult lives, attached to the digital teat, as it were, which, so far as I can tell from what little interaction I've had with that cohort, has basically made them even worse in many ways in regards to the whole social sexual dysfunction thing.
Yeah, because I remember the first time I remember using the internet, I think for the first time, is when I was in fifth grade, and that was like in 96. then social media, like starting with MySpace, it didn't become really big until my senior year of high school. So I spent most of my childhood and teen years without social media. But someone who's been born since the early 90s, that's all they know.
Yeah, and I mean, this is slightly off topic, but you see all these kids now just sort of mouthing off on Twitter and Facebook about any sort of idea as to what repercussions it could have. Like, whenever one of my articles goes viral, I've got, like, teenage girls screaming at me in some fashion, and I'm just thinking to myself, you know, your brains are not – you're not old enough to drive. You don't have the – you're not old enough to have the social maturity to express these opinions, yet you're screaming at a stranger and making threats over the internet. Do you realize that how that could get you in trouble? I mean, it's like where are the parents? I mean, you get to the extreme of these, like, viral – like that Jesse Slaughter girl who was attacked by 4chan 4 years ago after she was, like, threatening them and whatever. It's like, where are the parents? Where's the where is the order in these kids' lives? But no, all they have to raise them is the freaking internet.
Is there anything you could say positive about the millennials? I've noticed among political or cultural dissidents, I think millennials have a unique perspective that other generations don't have. Is there anything positive you can say?
Well, going by the theories in the fourth turning, I mean, I'm sort of cynical about this, but I do think that in the event of a social crisis, the millennials will help turn things around. And I think our biggest asset, and again, I think I discussed this with Andy Noelke at one point, our biggest asset is that we have no memory of a functioning America. So there's no nostalgia, there's no idea of what we've lost, so we can more effectively imagine a better future. I mean,
I'll give you one example of that. The first major like historical event in history that I have that I can remember is the LA riots.
Yeah, something like that. It's like the examples I gave talking to Andy Noelke is like, you know, the earliest president I can remember was Bill Clinton. You know, by the time
I can
remember,
I mean, I can obviously not remember Reagan, but I can actually remember the first George Bush Senior.
Yeah. Basically, our entire lives, more or less, we've seen that our leaders are corrupt buffoons. We've seen that the media is corrupt and pushes degeneracy. We see basically nothing good, which will, I think in the event of a social crisis, the millennials may surprise everyone in turning everything around. I mean, I'm not going to stake any money on it because my innate cynicism prevents me from putting anything on this, but it's like, I don't know. I mean, I certainly don't see anything coming from, say, no offense to the Gen Xers. I don't see anything coming from the Gen Xers. And of course, the boomers are the people who got us into this mess to begin with.
And is it too soon to notice any trends for the generation younger than us? The one that Paul Bingham calls them Generation Maggot.
I honestly can't really say. Going back to the fourth turning, by that the theory, according to their theory of generational civilizational cycles, the generation born from 1990 forward is a silent generation. I mean that's not the exact term they use, but the last generation that was like that would be the silent generation, which was came of age in the 50s and 60s and was responsible for help shepherding through, you know, the Great Society and Vietnam, more or less. They're going to be more or less defined by the fact that they grow up after the society has more or less been rebuilt. It will be the millennials who build a new society. The generation after that will come of age while that society is going up. I can't say any concrete trends I see emerging from that group right now, but they're basic. Going by the fourth turning, they're more or less their purpose more or less is just to more or less be dutiful workers. They're not like big revolutionary types in the way that the millennial generation, the hero generation, and the boomers, the profit generation, are supposed to be.
And I think with the millennials, I mean, I think the majority of them are pretty pathetic, but it's going to be a small, I think there's going to be a, there could be very well be a segment of the millennials that bring about change, but it definitely won't be the majority.
I think you could say that for the majority of generations. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it wasn't not every single boomer was out there doing it in the road. It was a small minority. Same with Gen X, whatever. It's always going to be the talented minority who leads things, you know.
And I guess before I move on to a different topic, is there anything else you can add about millennials? I guess we can say is what do you see as the how are millennials different in regards to relationships and sex than the Generation X?
The big thing that separates millennials is that everything is mediated through a screen. Like I gave as an example in the article, the rise of Tinder, which is basically, you know, a hookup app. You're on Tinder for one reason and one reason only. It's to get laid quickly. There's no flirtation. There's no banter. There's no dating. You just swipe right and bam, you arrange a meeting and bam, you have sex. And you've got, I think it's the Twitter feed, Tinder Fessions, which is where both guys and girls are confessing all the ways they've hooked up on, you know, Tinder. And I was just basically in many ways it's a form of narcissism, because you're not looking the people going on Tinder are not looking for any sort of connection. They're not looking for any sort of excitement or fun. They just want the certainty of an orgasm. They want the certainty of basic pleasurable enjoyment, which is divorced of any sort of connection, divorced of any sort of meaning. Just it's pardon my French, it's basically one step above masturbation.
Yeah, it reminds me of a lot of this stuff reminds me of the book Brave New World.
Oh yeah, basically. We're living in that world right now. And I don't suspect it's going to last much longer, but you know, again, I'm not going to stake any money on that.
Yeah, I mean I can't say I can predict the future, but would you say that you'll see the current society, will it collapse and get rebuilt, something new will get rebuilt, or do you think we'll be stuck in this situation for a very long time?
Honestly, I've been somewhat removed from the news cycle because I've been living in the Philippines for the past month, but I've been sort of following what's been happening in Ferguson, Missouri, the suburb of St. Louis, which is apparently full of riots, and it's tempting to say that things will continue on as they are, but it's like I don't think anyone would have predicted what would happen is happening in Ferguson right now. So, like right now, we have a very comfortable sort of existence in the U.S., but there are any number of variables that could go wrong at any moment. And I'm not gonna say we're gonna go to like some sort of Mad Max sort of, you know, apocalypse scenario, but I do think a great social change is gonna be coming in the next 5-10 years.
And with Ferguson, Missouri, I know a lot of pro-white nationalist types. Their flaw is that they're looking at Ferguson from a purely a racial standpoint as a black issue. But I think I don't really see it purely as about that. I see it as a broader issue of societal decline. I think that there's more to that than just the black aspect.
Yeah. The most interesting perspective I've seen on this is W.F. Price of The Spearhead pointing out how you have people in the leftists in the media and whatever. I forget the exact name of the guy he talks about. We're helping to foment sort of, you know, this violence in Ferguson and you got other people pointing out, you know, the sort of hypocrisy of the left on this. Like a few months ago when I think it was Cliven Bundy was in that standoff against the federal marshals in Nevada, the leftists were saying, bring in the National Guard, shoot them down, Cliven Bundy is a domestic terrorist. We had the same situation going on in Ferguson now, and those same leftists are now claiming that, you know, police brutality, the police are racist, don't clamp down. It's basically the center cannot hold, and we're seeing the two main divergent groups of whites in the U.S., the left and the right, more or less, being pulled further and further apart on this issue. And I really don't suspect this arrangement is going to last a whole lot longer.
Yeah, I mean, both the liberals and conservatives are both intellectually bankrupt.
Yeah, I mean, I use those terms more or less as a sort of thing. I'm talking more or less about the different cultures, the culture of the blue states, what the Mencius Moldbug would call the Brahmins versus the Vasyas, the white middle class. Both groups are more separate now than they've ever been. They hate each other. the Brahmins more or less have declared full on war with the Vaisya of all with the Vaisyas with all the middle class of all these purges of anyone who is racist or misogynistic or transphobic. I really don't see this as a recipe for long term social stability. But again, I could be wrong.
And you try to like stay away from politics, but you would probably you say you have kind of a mixture of a left wing and right wing views as to why.
More or less, yeah. I have some radical left wing sort of views on economics, maybe not all, but some, and some right wing views on things, and some libertarian views on things. I do think that the future social order is going to incorporate some or all these sorts of things. Like, say, for instance, like dealing with the fact that most jobs in the U.S., so-called job growth, is coming from low-income minimum wage jobs and the increasing use of automation. We're going to have to find some way to deal with that without, say, maybe a guaranteed minimum income or something like that, because we're ending up with huge swaths of people in the U.S. right now who are being put out of work due to the closure of manufacturing plants and the moving the growth of factory farms and taking over family farms, but they don't have the capacity to retrain and become high tech, workers or whatever. So.
And these are not just like a bunch of like lazy degenerate, like the stereotype of the lazy degenerate proletariats. These are a lot of high caliber intelligent people who are becoming economically obsolete.
Yeah. Not all of them are intelligent, but you can say they're decent people. You know? It's like you got like, people at manufacturing plants in upstate New York. They worked for the company their entire lives, raised families, had kids, stayed by the law. And then when they're 50 and they're on the cusp of retirement, the company moves to Mexico and bam, they're left with nothing, not even their retirement.
So, you're in the Philippines right now. What are some of the observations that you've made about that country and that are dramatically different than United States?
Well, the big thing, and I actually talked with Arush over this. I've interviewed him for my own podcast, and the big thing I noticed here is that smartphone technology is almost as ubiquitous here as it is back in the U.S. Even the poor people in the Philippines have smartphones, and you've got this sort of weird situation from an American perspective where you're walking through town and you got all these shacks everywhere and sort of rundown places, but they're hawking like smartphone data cards. But even with all the use of smartphones, Filipinos are not glued to them in the way that Americans are. Like, they view them as a purely utilitarian thing to keep in contact with people. You don't see people using earbuds to listen to music on the road. When you go to malls or bars or public places, you actually see people talking to each other and having a good time. Basically, even with the infiltration of modern technology in some American culture, the Philippines is still very much a place where the social contract is intact, and people actually enjoy talking to each other and being social and being a community.
What is the attitude that they have towards you as an American? Are they friendly towards Americans or distrustful?
They're friendly to Americans to the point of outright obsequiousness. I don't have the data on file, but a survey of countries' attitudes about America, the Philippines is the most pro-American country in the world. It's more pro-America than Americans are about their own country.
And that benefits you personally, but I don't blame people in other countries for hating America. I totally don't blame them.
Well, it benefits me personally, and it benefits Americans and foreigners in general, because if you – there's to contrast with the Philippines with another similar country, I'd say Thailand. Thailand is known for its – it basically caters to foreigners and foreign travel, but Thais really don't care too much for foreigners. They have a derisive term for them, farang, and basically if you're a foreigner, you will never ever be able to penetrate into – Thai culture beyond the lowest rungs. In fact, most Thai women of the middle class and upper class would absolutely refuse to have anything to do with a foreigner. Whereas in the Philippines, everybody wants to be your friend if you're a foreigner, and not in a predatory way, but in an honest, you know, they think you're cool kind of way. From a romantic standpoint, you have a lot of cachet as a white man. And the particular city where I live, Davao, is probably safer in many ways than many cities back in the U.S. I mean, I was in Chicago.
So you wouldn't compare it to like Mexico.
No. I mean, obviously it's still a poor country with a lot of poverty, but it's much nicer than people would think it is. Like I said, this particular city, Davao, is a lot safer than, say, Chicago. I can walk these streets at night here, and I don't get pickpocketed. I don't even get leered at, because the people here actually seem to give a damn about maintaining a cohesive community with what they have.
And you said you describe it as a friendly extrovert culture.
Friendly extrovert culture is pretty much, yeah. Like, Filipinos are ridiculously social. I mean, just a couple hours ago, the people at my condo were having a karaoke party outside my front door. And I'm walking along. It's like, hey man, join us. And like I hung around for a little bit. I mean, I'm a little sick, so I couldn't hang around too much. But it's like, if you're a foreigner, if you're just, you know, as long as you leave the house, you know, it's like you're gonna run into adventures everywhere you go. I mean, obviously there's a seedy side to the Philippines as there is in any country or anywhere in Southeast Asia, but so long as you keep your nose clean and don't engage in anything illegal, you're gonna have an easy time here. Most of the problems that the foreigners run into abroad are the sorts of things that would get you in trouble back home too, like doing drugs.
Like the show, there's a show called Locked Up Abroad, but most of those people, they're doing most cases are doing like stupid shit like smuggling drugs in an airplane.
Oh yeah, basically. If you're a drug smuggler, you're gonna the Philippines, from what I understand, is one of the few countries that still gives the death penalty to drug smugglers. If you're soliciting prostitutes, you're gonna run into trouble. If you're committing crimes, you're gonna run into trouble. But if you're just a normal person, you don't get obsessively drunk. You're polite to the locals. They'll return that kindness very easily.
Have you had any interactions with the police there?
Technically, I have interactions with the police every day, because one of the big things about this particular city, Davao, they take safety very seriously. So every reputable business, all the malls, even many of the bars, have a policeman stationed outside. So technically, you're interacting with them every day, but they're always very polite. They're always helpful. You have to go for a metal detector in order to go to any of the malls, but the police there don't lord their power over you.
They're not like American cops are bigger assholes.
Oh yeah, I mean, the comparison would be like TSA agents, who clearly many of them get a thrill out of, you know, just abusing the weak. Whereas the Filipinos are just like, you know, they don't like doing it, but it's their job, and they have to in order to keep these places safe. You know, it's almost like they're practically sorry every time they have to sort of, you know, frisk you to make sure you're not carrying any weapons. You know.
And what have your experiences with dating have been there?
Well, like I said, if you're a white man, or even really just a foreigner in general, you have a huge advantage because, well, everyone's going to say cynically because, oh, they just want a green card. But like I said, most of the women I've interacted with are from a middle class or upper working class background. And technically, my current girlfriend is more educated than me. She's studying to be a nurse. But The big thing that Filipino women see in white men or foreign men is that, you know, they're a little less traditional. They're willing to sort of carry their weight around the house because you have a sort of weird situation in the Philippines where a lot of women work and a lot of women are going to college and get educated. You know, it's no big deal here, but at the same time, they're still expected to be to be domestic wives at home, and in a lot of cases the men are not either underemployed or unemployed. So you have an advantage here in that, you know, if you don't have to be rich, but it's like, you know, you're willing to pull your own weight around the household, a little less traditional. to Filipinos, you know, foreign men represent sort of, you know, an escape from the drudgery of the day-to-day lives. And the girls are just really, really nice. I mean, they have their own sort of suite of games that they sort of play. But, I mean, not to sound too crass, but if you're a man and you can't get laid in the Philippines, you should probably just kill yourself, because it is the easiest place in the world to find a good wife, find someone, a caring girlfriend, or just, you know, plow for a lot of girls if that's your thing.
And before I move on to a different topic, is there anything else you'd like to add about the Philippines?
I'd say one thing I would add is that culture shock is very real. I decided to go to the Philippines in many ways because as my first sort of real international adventure, is because it's sort of like playing the game on easy. Like, you don't have to learn a foreign language here because English is one of the official languages of the Philippines, and pretty much everybody you'll meet here speaks it. But even still, the culture is different enough that you're going to experience whiplash if you aren't sort of prepared. I mean, when I first got here, it's like, well, when I first got here, I think I slept for like 14 hours straight because of jet lag. But the next couple of days, I was sort of I didn't really want to do anything social, because every time I, you know, left the house, it was like, you know, everyone was being nice to me. I wasn't having any bad experiences, but it's like everything here is just so different enough that my brain has difficulty processing it. So if you're not just the Philippines, but any sort of foreign culture in general, if you're planning to spend a good deal of time abroad, you should be prepared to deal with culture shock, and because it will have an effect on your ability to do things, you know, just your ability to sort of, you know, process things mentally. I mean, it takes some time to get over.
So you reviewed this book called Some Thoughts on Hitler and Other Essays by Erman Vinson, and there's a foreword by Kevin MacDonald, and it's edited by Greg Johnson from Countercurrents. And you say you're not a fan of it, but you can't hate it either, because it accomplishes its goals without making any major missteps. What originally gave you the interest to review this book?
Wow. I mean, I think I reviewed that like a year ago, I think.
But... Oh, yeah. You know what? For some reason it showed up, but it said July 2013, but for some reason it showed up in the recent archives.
Oh, well, that's weird. Anyway, the main reason I read the book and reviewed it was because I think Countercurrents had a free giveaway day for the Kindle version. I just snapped up because it was free. It was like, what the hell? And it's not a bad book. Like, I'm not saying that. The book's subject matter is a bit outside of my field of interest. I mean, I can see where someone who would be interested in the Holocaust, someone who's interested in the Jewish question, someone who's interested in white nationalism would enjoy it, but it personally left me feeling a little empty. I don't want to bash because it's a very well put together book. It just didn't appeal to my particular tastes.
And that's part of the reason. I mean, I think there's a lot of great things about Countercurrents. I don't want to come across as like dissing them or bashing them, but that is part of the reason why I made a decision to go independent and do my own show instead of being hosted there, because I felt that they were too, the focus was on those particular issues.
The book, basically, if I recall correctly, like I said, I wrote that review well over a year ago, but the book is basically focuses on Holocaust question, questions of Judaism and Jews' role in the Western civilization, and more broader topics on whiteness and white nationalism. One of the most interesting things I learned from the book is, if I recall correctly, again, I might be confusing it with another book, but Erman Vinson goes over how basically the current obsession with the Holocaust really didn't begin until around the 60s. According to his research, even shortly after World War II, I mean, everyone knew the Holocaust had happened, but it didn't really register in the Western public consciousness as a big event. I mean, obviously, people were upset at the sight of Jews having been killed and other people having been killed in these camps, but it did not become the big occasion for, history and I guess remembrance until roughly around the time the civil rights era came into a play, and less scrupulous Jewish leftists realized that with the grievance industry, with blacks getting civil rights and whatnot, that it would be a perfect time for them to sort of jump on the gravy train, as it were. I mean, without sounding too cynical, again, I'm not a Holocaust denialist. I mean, obviously it was a horrible thing, but we can't deny that there are a lot of figures who have abused the Holocaust for their own personal gain.
And what are some of your biggest criticisms of that kind of politics?
Basically, the most obvious one is that Germans specifically and whites in general are made to flagellate themselves for a crime that basically none of us had anything to do with. I mean, pretty much everyone who was directly involved in the Holocaust is dead now, or they've been adequately punished. And yet, every sort of nationalist stirring, every sort of attempt at whites to be proud of themselves or proud of – or individual countries to have nationalisms, say English being proud of being English or French being proud of being French, Germans being proud of being Germans. This – as soon as you say something like that, some leftists will jump up and say, well, you're just as bad as the Nazis, because guess what happens when you become nationalist? You suddenly want to kill 6 million Jews. So the Holocaust is basically used as a tool to beat down any sort of semblance of nationalism. I mean, again, when it comes to what Hitler and the Nazis did, that was obviously morally wrong and a disgusting and reprehensible thing. But not every instance of nationalism is going to end with some group being I mean, we've gone too far in the opposite direction, where whites are now expected to be masochistic, self-loathing, hate themselves for being white, and allow their countries to be overrun with minorities who are hostile to their traditions and have no interest in integrating and just want to leech off the system.
And you see in Europe, nationalism, not so much in the United States, but in Europe, it's on the rise.
Yes. Probably one of the – I think that's one of the big things we're going to see as the sort of – realistically, the cult around the Holocaust is starting to fade because, as I mentioned, everyone who was directly involved in the Holocaust, either as a victim of it or as a perpetrator, is dead. It's basically becoming another historical event for most people growing up. You see one of the big things I've seen in the past couple of months. Again, as you said, the rise of nationalism, but there's a lot more open criticism of Israel in the mainstream media. And I remember just as recently as 5 years ago, if you so much as criticized Israel on anything in the mainstream media, you would immediately be tarnished as an anti-Semite.
I've noticed that change as well.
Yeah, now everyone's talking about the Palestinian plight. Everyone's talking about how Israel's recent incursion into Gaza is a bad thing. You've got
even,
there was that huge
even
there was
John
that huge
Stewart. John Stewart did a piece about that.
Oh yeah. And there was that huge riot in Paris between, I think it was Jews and Muslims over the Israel issue. I'm not offering one opinion one way or the other. I mean, the whole Israel thing is really not a huge concern to me. But I think this is really interesting and sort of shows that discourse on the Holocaust, discourse on Judaism, discourse on Israel is taking a very different turn now that the Holocaust generation and the older generation of Jews and people who were affected by it are starting to die off and lose prominence in the media.
So you're saying if the younger generation, they're less like that, the younger generation?
Yes, I mean, I think I wrote about this somewhere else, but there was a study done on a young American Jews by a Jewish group, and they showed that young Jews are either indifferent to Israel or they actually sympathize with the Palestinians. There really aren't that many ardent Zionists among the under 30 Jewish set in the U.S. anymore, because to most Americans, most younger Americans, either if they're hardened leftists, they side with the Palestinians because you know leftists tend to side with quote unquote oppressed minority peoples everywhere, or at best, you know, they see it as having nothing to do with them. You know, Israel's a country on the other side of the world. It has no effect on their lives. They're not particularly invested in their own Judaism, so they don't really care about it, which is a huge shift from the I remember 10 years ago with the there was just support for Israel was at an all-time high. You couldn't say anything bad about Israel on either the left or the right without being tarnished as an anti-Semite, but now the discourse on that is being blown wide open. And I say that's because of the rising of the younger generations who have no special connection to Israel and no nothing invested in the Holocaust.
I actually remember this. You had an article back at your old Malafita blog, and you said that you were simultaneously opposed to anti-Semitism as well as anti-anti-Semitism.
Well, I don't know if I describe it like that anymore, but what annoys me is reflexive thinking on either side of the list. I mean, my views are pretty much identical, I'd say, to Andy Nowicki's. He had an interesting video recently on his thoughts on the Jews, where it's like, you know, there is a lot of malign Jewish influence in American culture and American in the American government. Yet, I'm not going to condemn all Jews for this because. Well, number one, the Jews as a tribe have a right to exist as much as any other tribe. Not all Jews are evil, and
so
a lot
think,
of that.
There's a segment of the old, not. I wouldn't say it's the majority of alternative right, but there is this faction of the alternative right that just all people. They basically say, "Oh, they're all evil," which I think is really that's totally idiotic, and I think it does a lot of harm.
Yeah, I mean. To put it a certain way, you know, we don't have to go full retard on this. We can criticize the negative influences that Jews have had on Western culture, yet without going into full war, the Jews are evil, the evil incarnate, because they're not, you know. All of us are human, all of us are flawed, all of us are, you know, equally, maybe not equally, but all of us are jerks, and we can discuss these issues in a rational and factual basis without, you know, turning into either, you know, idiotic leftists who scream about racism and Nazism, or foaming at the mouth Nazis who just want to bash on the Jews.
So you said that both sides are equally idiotic.
More or less. I mean, yeah.
The PC, they're idiotic in different ways. The politically correct types are idiotic because they're the establishment, the hardcore Nazi types, they're marginalized, but they're bad in the sense that I think they hold back a movement like the alternative right from becoming viable.
Yeah, more or less, because the rational voices get drowned out by the nut jobs. And damn it, I lost my train of thought there. But basically, it's like there is room for nuance on this. There's room for nuance on everything. Like the fact that the like as you said, the left and the right are morally sort of intellectually bankrupt. I say both ardent anti-Semites and anti-anti-Semites are morally bankrupt. Intellectually bankrupt.
Yes.
And the real answer lies in between. Maybe not necessarily in between those two extremes. I don't want to sound like some sort of triangulating centrist, but it involves a bit more thought than, you know, reflexively saying all Jews are bad or all Jews are good.
Yeah, it's like having I don't want to have to pick between like David Duke and Abe Foxman.
that's a perfect way to put it, Robert. Yeah.
Yeah, as you said, I think Andy Nowicki basically has like the right perfect nuance on it. I know a lot of people. I mean, I'm not a hyper moralistic person, but you could say Andy Nowicki is kind of like the moral compass of the alternative right.
Yeah, he's the guy to keep us grounded. And bringing him up, there's one other thing he brought up that I want to remind everyone of. He pointed out in those videos that he sees a lot of people saying, well, Jews are nasty, the Jews are selfish, the Jews do this, the Jews do that, but we should be more like them. We should be just as cunning and evil than they are. And he's saying, well, you shouldn't be like that, because if you're just as bad as your enemies, then what does that make you, you know? If we're going to be good moral people, shouldn't we have some sort of, you know, moral standard for our conduct and how we treat people?
And before I move on to a different topic, touch on something briefly. Do you know who Luke Ford is?
The name rings a bell, but I don't know him specifically.
I recently interviewed him. His story is he was a fan. He basically was a porn journalist. His moniker he got labeled the Matt Drudge of porn, and he's a convert to Orthodox Judaism. But he actually said he became sympathetic towards white nationalism because of his from being basically an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. And there was something else. In many ways, you can sort of see this between. I mean, again, I'm not saying I'm aligned with either one of these groups, but you see sort of white separatists and black separatists in many ways, like the new Black Panther Party, groups that theoretically should hate each other, but instead maybe not necessarily love each other, but they have a weird sort of respect for each other because, as a sort of when you get farther into this sort of, taking care of your own people and taking care of your own side, you sort of start to see, well, basically everyone else has the same right to do the same thing that you're doing, So.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually say politically, I actually probably am more common politically with a lot of blacks than I do, like, say, like a country club Republican type.
Yeah, pretty much. So I can definitely see where a guy like Lou Ford is coming from that. I mean, I think there was another major figure who said that, I forget who, that said basically studying more about his Judaism helped move him to the right, more or less politically, or less understanding the struggles of white Americans to retain their identity. Basically, when it comes down to it, like I said, when you realize, when you put the defense of your tribe or your people first, you realize that basically, well, why don't other people have that same right? If blacks can defend their own tribe, whites can defend their own tribe, Jews can, Latinos can, Asians can. There's no if one is right, then the other is right. If one is wrong, then all the other ones are wrong.
So I'll save the most, I guess, kind of taboo topic for last. I guess all our topics have been kind of controversial, but you reviewed this film. It's called Are All Men Pedophiles?
Yes, the film is more or less an exploration of male sexual desire and male sexual proclivities. Basically, the question posed by the documentary is that, basically, in our culture, being attracted to girls under 18, who have gone through puberty, obviously, is considered taboo. Yet, throughout history, men have married, had sex with girls in their teens, and even sort of, I guess, maybe not tweens, but like from like 14, 13 to maybe around 18. And this was natural and a part of human sexuality. And the sort of way we lump all that sexual desire for women in that age group in with actual pedophilia, which is the sexual desire for prepubescent children, is both illogical, and it's actually harmful to modern men and modern society in general.
I mean, if you look at society, our attitude's so insane. I mean, 18-year-old girls can be in all the most like disgusting, degrading porn imaginable, but if a guy says he likes a 17-year-old girl, oh, that guy's a pedophile. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and like I said, the line, basically, 1 year separates like a girl that you can't touch from one you can touch. And like I said, an 18-year-old can basically do all sorts of disgusting, depraved things on camera, but say,
But one did not just a year, one day.
yeah, one day. It's like there's no like magical. I mean, 18, I suppose, has some, there's a reason the age of majority is 18, because, but at the same time, it's like there's no huge magical leap between 17 and 18. Realistically, if you want to get down to it, most people really don't mature, particularly men, maybe around maybe 25, 26, which is around maybe when your brain stops developing. But the way we sort of approach these things with sexual desire and pedophilia really doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, so have you seen that chart Robert Lindsay had a chart called Are All he titled it like All Men Are Pedophiles, and he did this chart that said he was saying like adult like normal non-pedophiliac men might have like a very mild attraction to pedophilia. So he was kind of joking and saying all men are pedophiles. I think he took it, but then he took it down because he said he pulled it off the chans and it wasn't enough like valid source. But then he totally like trolled himself.
I missed this, but I wouldn't exactly agree with him there, but basically, as the whole thesis of this movie are all men pedophiles, is that basically we should stop. We should this whole thing has very real effects on society. Like, to give an example of the way that sex offenders are treated, we have in the U.S. we have the sex offender registry, and if you commit a sex crime, your name goes on that registry. You have to inform the government when you move, where you live. You have to inform employers that you're on it, which makes it almost impossible to get a job. Like. I was living and working in the North Dakota oil fields a couple years ago. I was friends with a pastor who was defending. He had acquired a somewhat unsavory reputation because the local paper had smeared him as defending sex offenders. But the sex offenders he was defending was a couple of men he was trying to help get work. These men, their sex offense was having sex with their 17-year-old girlfriends when they were the age of majority. That's not a sex offense in any reasonable definition of the word. And now we've got the rise of smartphones. We've got kids who are being investigated for trafficking in child pornography because they send pictures of their genitals to each other. There's one particularly weird case, and I think it was Virginia, of a 15-year-old boy who sent a picture of his penis to his girlfriend. The girlfriend's parents found it. They had this guy arrested. And in order to prove that it was, in fact, this kid's penis, the police, the prosecution, actually took him and took pictures of his penis using their own equipment to prove this in court.
They did the same thing.
Yeah, basically, in order to prove that this kid was trafficking in child pornography, they were trafficking in child pornography, the police department. It's completely insane.
Or another case I heard about is there was a state where the age of consent was 17, but a guy who was like 19, he took pictures of him having sex with a 17-year-old girlfriend, and it's basically the charge for production of child porn. It's like a mandatory 15 years in federal prison.
I remember that quickly. I think the guy's name was Gennaro Wilson, and it was in Georgia.
No, it wasn't. That case was just statutory rape. That wasn't a child porn case. That was different. This case, I think, was Indiana.
Oh, okay. But it's still the same sort of concept. You know, it's like it just doesn't make any sense the way we as a society view these things.
So, Matt, we covered a lot of different really interesting issues. So, Matt Forney, thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me on again, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.